The Guardian.
I'm James Randerson, and this is Science Weekly for March the 24th. Coming up on this week's show...
When we destroy or weaken the ecosystem by letting parts of it die, then we are hurting ourselves. You must agree that it's just morally wrong to destroy large parts of the rest of life.
We get a tour through biodiversity and conservationism from E.O. Wilson, the scientist who's been called Darwin's natural heir. Also in the show, we'll reveal why Michelangelo's David is feeling stressed. Plus...
Education should, in my view, be lifelong. We should be seeking to learn and relearn, to keep up to date, to challenge our own assumptions, to reflect, and to change our minds when logic and the evidence compel.
Education, education, education. Philosopher A.C. Grayling gives us his thoughts on the science of learning. And Heisenberg's uncertainty principle explained through the medium of song.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
Welcome one and all to our non-Easter Easter special. Now that might just give you a clue to a certain novelist who we'll be paying tribute to later in the show. And happily, it also happens to be the theme tune for the man who's helping me out on the microphone duties this week. Bobby Johnson is Guardian's technology correspondent and star of the Mighty Tech Weekly podcast. And that theme tune also happens to occur every time he walks into the room. Why is that, Bobby?
It's amazing, isn't it? It's that and a spaceship stretches out in front of me for miles on end. It's like Star Wars meets 2001.
Wow, that must have just taken a bit of getting used to. Well, we've also got Nell here, which is great. Nell Bose from the Arts blog to keep us on the straight and narrow. How many Easter eggs did you eat, Nell?
Oh, not none yet.
No, it's...
Oh, of course. It's the weird slick time.
We'll start this week with a scientific colossus. E.O. Wilson, or Edward to his friends, is one of the world's most influential living biologists. He's a legend in the fields of biodiversity, entomology and ecology, and is also an all-round advocate for environmentalism. He's one of the world's leading humanists, and he's been described as Darwin's natural heir. All in all, then, quite the grand fromage. Well, Wilson's spoken in the past about flying blind into our environmental future. But just what does he mean by this? Asking the questions for Science Weekly is Mirko Herr, a journalist with Welt der Wunder in Germany.
The bottom line is that estimates have been made, careful estimates, that if climate change alone is not abated or measures taken to, you know, circumvent its effects on biodiversity, we could lose or have close to extinction approximately a quarter, one fourth of the species of plants and animals on the land within the next 50 years, and half lost by the end of the century. Notice I said, if we don't do anything to abate these effects, that's why it's so important we understand what's happening and that, in fact, we do take measures to abate it.
So you could say, well, when you hear these numbers, we're losing so many species, but do we have to worry? I mean, when we lose one frog species or something like that, is that a tragedy?
The loss of every species is a tragedy for humanity, because every species is a masterpiece of evolution. Most species are ancient by human standards. The great majority once described, once gone, in fact, all of them once gone, all those that become extinct are extinct forever. We could never recover them. And each one is exquisitely well adapted to its environment and interlocked with other species so that when it disappears, it affects their chances of survival. And all together, they form the very foundation of our own existence. We depend on far more than just our energy sources, far more on just potable water, you know, getting enough water to drink, far more on a place to grow crops. We depend on the integrity and survival of the ecosystems and these millions of species that make up the ecosystem. So there's every reason to treat the loss of each and every species as a tragedy. Think also about the huge amount of scientific information we can get from each species. And in addition, possible practical uses concerning such as pharmaceuticals, new medicines that can be derived, sometimes from very surprising sources, new products, new fibers, for example, new crops, new genes for crops. All of these are potential gifts from each individual species. And then we know that as the more species disappear, we know from theory and also from experiments that are performed that the whole ecosystem and that's losing the species becomes less stable. It is less likely to recover from severe drought and other environmental shocks, and it is also less productive. It is able to produce less material with the sunlight it receives. And we also should bear in mind that these natural ecosystems give us great services. It's been estimated that when you total all of the services that they give us in pollination, in water purification, water storage, water distribution, the restoration of soil, of stabilization of the atmosphere, that the equivalent euro-dollar value of that would be, is at the present time, approximately equal to the total productivity of humanity, the gross world domestic product, all the domestic products of the world, the nations put together. And we get that scot-free. When we destroy or weaken the ecosystems by letting parts of it die, then we are hurting ourselves. And then finally, the argument that I have been putting forward, including in my recent book addressing religious believers, this book is The Creation, there's the moral aspect. It's just morally wrong, whether you're a religious believer, whether you are a secularist, you must agree that it's just morally wrong to destroy large parts of the rest of life.
Friend of the pod, Mirko Hare there, speaking to E.O. Wilson. You can hear the full half-hour interview in this week's Science Extra. Wilson discusses all sorts of topics, from extraterrestrial life forms to the prospects of a reverse on climate change by the next US president. Head back to guardian.co.uk/science for more. I'm James Randerson, and you're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian. Still to come, philosopher and arch-atheist A.C. Grayling gives us his thought for the pod. Plus, a brand new song from the Science Weekly troubadour, Johnny Berliner. That's all coming up, but first, let's find out about the other science stories making the headlines over the past 7 days. Here's Nell and Bobby with your News Jam.
News Jam.
Would-be dads should consider taking folic acid supplements to improve their chances of fathering a child, according to researchers. They found a link between high levels of the nutrient in men's diets and the genetic quality of sperm.
Michelangelo's David may look relaxed, but he's actually rather stressed, especially around his left thigh, right shin and ankles. A new analysis of the statue predicts where it is most under strain based solely on its shape. The method could be used to predict where cracks will occur before they happen.
Stressed, anxious or depressed parents could be making their children unhealthy, according to a study that followed the health of 120 children over 3 years. The researchers found a clear link between anxiety and depression among parents and an increased chance of the child being ill and having a high temperature.
And finally, the science fiction novelist and space visionary Arthur C. Clarke died last Tuesday at his home in Sri Lanka. Best known for his epic novel 2001 A Space Odyssey, he never achieved his final ambition observing a meeting between aliens and humans.
Thanks, Bobby and Nell. Ben reckons he might now. We'll see. But, yeah, Bobby, you're a fan of Arthur C. Clarke.
And all science fiction, kind of.
Join the club, we're all geeks.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this we have to remember, this is not just a man who is well known for the books that he wrote, but is also contributed to science and technology over the years. Back in the day, he was a radar operator for the RAF during the Second World War.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And then he was one of the people who came up with the idea of geosynchronous satellites. So he's helped kind of shape the world we live in a number of ways. I find it really interesting because I'm quite interested in Asimov and Heinlein and Clarke, the big three of science fiction that emerged in the 40s. And it goes back to a magazine called Astounding Science Fiction, which was edited by a guy called Joseph W. Campbell. And he said, we want this really positive view of science and technology. And he started gathering all these writers together who could offer something that wasn't just pulp, you know, that was kind of high-minded, positive and important.
Well, talking of high-minded, do either of you know what the hell's going on at the end of 2001? You know, the film where he sort of descends to... It is rather different, actually, the two, but yeah, certainly in the film where the, you know, sort of turns into a baby and all that stuff, it's all very strange.
There are a number of movies that I always fall asleep during.
No, you can't. It's mesmerizing.
That and Apocalypse Now. I can never. I've had to watch these movies in like four separate sittings.
No,
so I can get through.
I saw a big screen, a big theatrical screening of 2001 a few years ago, and unfortunately happened to be sitting next to somebody who got completely freaked out during the entrance to the star portal because it reminded him strongly of an acid trip that he'd taken.
I was actually going to say to Bobby that the reason he's falling asleep is not taking enough drugs, but maybe this guy had taken.
There's a fine line that you can cross. I just want to make one final point about this, really, which is among technologists, Clarke's known for his three laws of prediction. The first two are actually a bit boring. They're just like, I can give them all to you, but. They're basically
slightly rubbish laws and the good
ones. Yeah. So the first one is basically a knock at scientists. When a distinguished but elderly scientist states that something's possible, he's almost certainly right. When he states that something's impossible, he's probably wrong. Number two is that the only way of discovering the limits of the possible is to venture into the impossible. But number three is the one that kind of always gets trotted out, which is that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And I think that's a kind of crystallises what Clarke means to a lot of people.
A good point to move on, I think. I was quite interested in the folic acid story this week.
Well, because you're a prospective father yourself.
Well, indeed, yes. The notion that folic acid is good for women who want to get pregnant is very well established. And, of course, it's to do with, it's an essential nutrient to do with neural tube development. And you get these neural tube defects like spina bifida if you don't have enough of it. But the idea that diet and specifically this nutrient for men's sperm is important is kind of a new one. And it was a study that looked at the diet of a group of men and also looked at the genetic quality of their sperm, and specifically chromosomal abnormalities like chromosome breaks or two chromosomes that were joined together. And they can lead to, you know, just not being able to conceive or things like Down syndrome. And they came to the conclusion that there was a link with folic acid. The more folic acid you had in your diet, either by having supplements or by eating green vegetables and things like that, the less likely you were to have these chromosomal problems. The interesting thing about it, though, was that talking to other researchers in the field, they kind of said, "Well, you know, this is a nice first step, but actually, it's a bit soon to be, you know, suggesting people go out and buy supplements or raid your wife's folic acid supplements, because although we see these problems, you know, in the lab, nobody's actually linked them to, nobody's done the study where, you know, you get someone to either take folic acid supplements or not, and then work out whether they're more likely or not to have to conceive a healthy child. And so they were saying, you know, we really need that kind of study before you can say anything really definitive. So
you won't be taking folic acid next year?
No, I mean, apparently the best thing to do is, you know, don't smoke, drink in moderation, and have a healthy, balanced diet, as is the answer to everything, I think.
We're all screwed.
I wanted to ask as well about the story about David. Are we going to save old Davy boy by analysing the stress? How does this work?
Well, it was quite a neat little study because it's quite simple. When I first read the paper, I kind of thought there'd be more to it. But essentially, I think there's a lot that goes on. There's a lot of computation here, which really went over my head. But it's quite simple, really. You just take a 3D map of whatever structure it is you're interested in, and then you apply a force to it. In this case, you're just thinking about gravity, but it could be another kind of force. And then you, just purely from the structure, you can work out using the algorithm these guys have developed where the stresses are in the structure. And they say the neat thing about it is that if you've got a priceless object that you don't want to do too much sort of destructive testing on, you can predict where those strains are going to be. And with David, where they predict the strains will be are where hairline fractures have started to appear in the marble.
It does sound kind of obvious, though, doesn't it? Don't architects and civil engineers do this?
Is this principally for use in buildings rather than fine art?
You could use it in buildings. You could use it in medical applications as well. If you're designing the shape of a kind
prosthetic
of
limb or something,
or an implant like a replacement hip or something like that. Let's leave that all there. If you want to have your say on any of these topics, post a comment on our Facebook wall or head to the science blogs at blogs.guardian.co.uk/science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Now, we've had a few posts from listeners who weren't convinced with our treatment of a certain crisp company and their efforts to advertise in space. We thought we dealt with the story with the contempt it deserved, but it's always your right to disagree. And Nicholas Carey from Northern Ireland did, strongly.
What kind of boneheaded editorial decision led you to falling for the PR claptrap involving a certain type of crisp? I read The Guardian and listen to the podcast because it gives me informed, non-hysterical and rational coverage of science issues that's sadly lacking in the popular press. This is not science. We have Ben Goldacre fighting a losing battle against this very type of sciencey speak and infiltration of advertising into science coverage. And then you go and give these brands the very publicity they crave! I expect more of The Guardian.
Whatever you do, Bobby, don't you dare say the name of that crisp company. But I think, I don't know, I sort of feel someone's missed the point.
Sorry. Well,
We sort of tried to take the piss.
The point is, in bad science, you have to talk about the bad science. You have to mention the names of the companies that you're saying are doing it. I thought that's what we were trying to do. But
I suppose his point is it's not even science.
But now we're carrying on discussing it even more.
But we're not mentioning the word.
No, and I'm not going to let you. Let's move on. Last week's Thought for the Pod, in which comedian Robin Ince gave his views on the relative merits of science and the arts, also had you all talking. Here's Don Felipe.
Just because I know my Bart from my Sartre doesn't mean I'm in the market to buy any magic crystals, any more than being a quantum physicist means that you'll be trapped in the kitchen at parties in an indeterminate state. Lazy thinking like this reinforces a dichotomy that doesn't exist. Most people I know, arty Pomo know-it-alls, nerdy M-theory wet dreamers, all have a healthy interest in each other's areas of expertise. Nevertheless, bravo for your efforts to heal the divide. It's hard to imagine, but in the 17th century, all human knowledge was regarded as science of one sort or another.
Well, that's settled then, sort of. Anyway, on to this week's monologue. Here's philosopher A.C. Grayling with his thoughts on the state of education. Listen carefully for those tweeting birds.
Education should, in my view, be lifelong. We should be seeking to learn and relearn, to keep up to date, to challenge our own assumptions, to reflect, and to change our minds when logic and the evidence compel. Few disagree with this sentiment, but few act on it either. An odd anomaly, given the pressure that rapid and complex change applies to us all in our speeded-up phase of history. But this doesn't diminish the importance of education in the first two decades of life, where the groundwork is laid for effective lifelong education. That obviously applies to numeracy and literacy skills, which in turn are the basis for handling and assimilating all sorts of information and acquiring all sorts of other skills. But chief among those skills is that of critical evaluation of the claims, assertions, suppositions, beliefs and arguments that shape the lives of individuals and countries both. As it happens, most people in history have lived, and indeed most people in the world today still live, in societies or cultures which actively oppose critical evaluation of the beliefs on which they base themselves, in some cases even threatening to kill people who dare to question the orthodoxies. Yet the most advanced and successful societies, in point of technological and social development and economic power, are precisely those where critical evaluation of orthodoxy has been most encouraged. Let's bring the general point here down to the particular. In the range of contemporary styles of school education on offer in the UK, by far the best is the International Baccalaureate. One of its compulsory elements is theory of knowledge, a course aimed at getting students to reflect critically on diverse ways of knowing and on areas of knowledge, and to consider the role and nature of knowledge in our own culture and in other cultures. I'm quoting here from the International Baccalaureate Organisation document on core curriculum requirements. And it also aims to make students aware of themselves as thinkers and to prompt them to understand the complexity of knowledge and to use it responsibly. These are excellent aims. This course should be compulsory in all schools everywhere. One outcome might be a better world.
A.C. Grayling there of Birkbeck College, London. We'll put the full text up on the site, so let us know what you think over at guardian.co.uk/science. Once more, alas, we're done for another week. Head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science for links to everything we've discussed in this week's show. We're back, as always, next week with a brand new podcast, and it'll be our second birthday show. So reasons to be cheerful if your Easter break hasn't done it for you. If, that is, you had one, unlike me. Science Weekly is produced by Ben Green. I'm James Randerson, and playing us out this week is Johnny Bellina.
Quantum world can be a touch absurd, describable in numbers but nonsense in words, where waves are really particles and particles are blurry. What can we infer from all of this? Everett said that there are infinite realities. The Copenhagen explanations sound like insanity, with consciousness affecting wavy particle dualities. The actualities are rather mysterious. There's a principle there ain't no denying, so learn from Werner Heisenberg and you will be flying. If you want a formula that you can rely on, then I got one for you. With Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, you can be uncertain for sure. With Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, you know where you are. What's more, if you know where you are, you will know your momentum, even if your Niels Bohr and he's smart. But you can certainly be certain how uncertain you are, sir, with Heisenberg's uncertainty law. You're measuring little things. There's a limit to how accurate you're measuring. It's defined by an equation. The equation really swings. So I'll sing it and you can see the standard deviation of the positions in precision times the standard deviation of the momentums in precision is greater than or equal to Planck's constant over 2. It's the same for time and energy. It is a principle, there ain't no denying. So learn from Werner Heisenberg and you will be flying. If you want a formula that you can rely on, then I've got one for you. With Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, you can be uncertain for sure. With Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, you know where you are. And what's more, if you know where you are, you can know your momentum, even if you're Niels Bohr and he's smart. You can certainly be certain how uncertain you are, sir, with Heisenberg's uncertainty law. Oh yeah, he's one swinging cat. Bet he's glad he ain't shrooming this cat.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.